We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see.
Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller have received countless awards and recognitions for their work, but the writers have said the greatest compliment is that fans still remember even their earliest songs. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
Cereal maker Kellogg's is asking a group that's working to defend Mayan culture to limit its use of an image of a toucan as the group's logo. The company is opposing the group's effort to trademark that logo. The company says consumers might confuse that image with Toucan Sam, the mascot of Kellogg's Fruit Loops cereal. The group called the Mayan Archaeology Initiative says that's not likely given that its logo is a realistic drawing of the tropical bird. Toucan Sam is a cartoon character resplendent in the colors of Fruit Loops. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is on their new website, trophytime.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. There are many people who argue that if the United States is to meet its need for energy and at the same time cut carbon emissions, that the country will have to increase its reliance on the use of nuclear power. There are certainly other people who argue that nuclear power has way too many negatives, including the high cost of plant construction and also the need to dispose of highly radioactive waste. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will return to a subject we certainly have discussed before, and that is nuclear power, its pros and cons. And this is the first of two programs that we will do this week, trying to bring you two different viewpoints. The guest for this show this morning is James Stubbins. He is the head of the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering in the College of Engineering at the U of I. He's also a professor in the department. In addition, he has done major consulting work for the U.S. Department of Energy, the Los Alamos National Laboratory, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and also the Argonne National Lab. And clearly, as you would expect, is somebody who feels that there certainly is potential for nuclear generation. A little later in the week, on Thursday, we'll be doing another program because we recognize that people will at least want to hear a different point of view. We'll be talking with Dr. Jordan Weaver. He is a science fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. So that'll be Thursday at 11 o'clock, and you'll have an opportunity to hear that. Of course, here on this program, you have the opportunity to call in and ask questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We also have email, so if you'd like to send along your comment that way, you can do that by writing to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask is that people just are brief so we can get in as many callers as possible, but certainly calls are welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
I'm very happy to be here.
We appreciate it. It seems that for nuclear power, at least perhaps for people who would advocate an increasing reliance on nuclear power, we're in an odd place now. As it is not very long ago, I think people were really expecting that we were inching towards a revival of the industry, and certainly people were talking about the need to build some new plants. Then in March, we had the tsunami and the earthquake in Japan, damaging some reactors there and causing a problem, which is likely to be a problem for quite a long time. And I think then that, certainly if you look at public opinion surveys, has led a lot of people to say they're very uneasy about the idea of nuclear power. So from your perspective, where exactly do you think we are now?
Well, I think we are in this period where we're reassessing how quickly we should go forward, and I think it depends country by country, what that particular approach might be. some countries have decided that going forward is not the best option for them. And other countries, including Japan in this case, is looking at how to go move forward, but much more cautiously than they would have in the past.
Yeah. Well, right now, how much of the electricity in the United States comes from nuclear generation?
The electricity, so about 40% of the energy we use is electric energy, and of that, about 20% is nuclear generated electricity. So of the total picture of all of the energy we use, it's only about 8 or 9% of the total energy, which includes oil and gasoline, all of the other energy sources.
But would you make the argument that it would be it would make sense for us to have nuclear generation be a larger piece of that?
I think so. I think the reason that nuclear came back on the scene so strongly is the tremendous concern about greenhouse gas emissions. And so the alternative typically for electricity production now is to burn primarily coal or in some cases natural gas. Now, I know people are enamored with wind power, but the amount of electricity that's currently generated by wind power is very small. And I think it's certainly should be part of the mix. I don't think that many nuclear people would argue against multiple energy sources, but we think nuclear should be one of them.
It's it has been quite a long time since anyone broke ground for a new plant in this country.
Well, people have broken ground for new plants. They haven't started really constructing new plants.
Okay, well, then maybe that's a better say. It's been a long time since anybody actually started. And in fact, the plant that's closest to us went online in 1987, and I think that it was actually one of the last plants in the United States to come online.
I think there was another few plants. The last came online in the early 90s. Apart from one that came online last year, I think last year or the year before, which was nearly completed, and in this period of redeveloping nuclear, it made sense to complete the plant. Yeah. There's now currently another one that's up for completion that's about half completed. These are both in the southeast. So there is some effort to do this, but these are plants that were started before. So not new construction. It's basically finishing construction that was started in the probably 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Well, that I suppose would lead some people to ask a question about, if nothing else, about the economics of nuclear power and say, well, if it would really make so much sense, why is it that people today aren't going out and building new nuclear plants?
And the answer is the economics is very different from a nuclear plant to other kinds of plants, to a coal-fired plant or to a gas turbine plant. The difficulty with nuclear is that it's very expensive to start with. The plant construction costs are large, and this is also dictated by the time it takes to build a plant, which many countries now have gotten down to maybe 4 years, which is a competitive time scale. But once the plant's built and it's operating, it turns out that the operation costs are much less than other kinds of plants. And this is because using uranium to make electricity, to make steam to make electricity, is much more cost efficient than using coal or oil or natural gas, any of the other sources. So nuclear plants have a big upfront cost and then low fuel costs as they operate, whereas the other plants are cheaper to construct but have continuing relatively large fuel costs as they operate.
But I'm sure some people would still say, well, okay, but then if it made sense, if it was a sound business decision to go in the business of nuclear plants, then somebody should be willing to spend the upfront cost with the idea that eventually they're going to be able to make money.
Yes, and I think if you talk to the people who own plants or who are in a position to build plants, they would certainly agree with that statement. The difficulty is that in order to do this, you need to borrow money. And it's the investment banks that would have to lend the money that see this as a much riskier investment than something else. And so this raises in addition to the other costs, it raises the cost of borrowing the money. Like most power operations, you pay for the plant before you put it in operation. You can only start charging in most cases, not quite in Illinois. In most cases, you can only start charging once the plant has become operational and you have a base to go to serve.
Mm-hmm. So what is it about a nuclear plant that makes it so much more, I don't know, is it more technologically complex?
Yes, it's more technologically complex. The components are larger scale typically and much more complex. The control systems and other kinds of safety systems are much more complex than you find even in a coal plant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cost of coal plants have gone up too, but this is because the environmental impact that they portend has to be paid for up front. So a lot of the cost, maybe a third of the cost of a typical coal plant would be for environmental controls, for emission controls from the gases.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then is that related to the fact that you're dealing with something that is highly radioactive and it's something that has to be contained?
I think also, yes, that's part of it. I think also it's the level of pressures that you need to keep these plants going and handling the steam. So they're typically much bigger than other size plants. So this adds the complexity. Also, the safety controls and the security, these kinds of issues are things that have to be dealt with in nuclear plants that are not so specifically important with fossil-fueled plants.
And our guest in this hour of Focus is James Stubbins. He's head of the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois. We're talking about nuclear energy, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here ready to go. We'll bring him into the conversation. This is someone in Mahomet, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I don't know if any of you heard. I heard on the BBC just a couple weeks after the nuclear accident in Japan, I heard that the nuclear people in Japan said that none of the security and none of the checking had been done on those plants for years, decades. And I only heard it once, and I never heard it again. But to me, this would be a devastating comment to make by your nuclear people if you had not done any security.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, I'd like to speak on the air, please.
I think we've gotten a couple of our lines crossed, but I do think we essentially got the question of the first guy. Yes.
I haven't heard anything quite as drastic as what was proposed there. But I think there are issues in Japan. There were issues in Japan about the way the regulators dealt with the plant security and safety issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think the system is much more robust in the U.S. There's a lot of lot more cooperation than would be healthy between the regulators and the plant operators in Japan. And so I think while this charge is not completely correct, I think there's something in this direction that the Japanese have now understand as a problem and need to work on to correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they haven't looked at anything over that period of time. I think it's a question of what level of scrutiny the plants were put through. Now, of course, there's a very high level of scrutiny for all the plants in Japan.
Mm. What, certainly not all American plants would be subject to that kind of accident. Although there may be other things, you do indeed, there are places in the United States where we have plants and we have earthquakes, so that might particularly be an issue. Do you feel that the kind of safety inspections that happen here and the kind of safety requirements that we have are adequate to prevent an accident on the scale of Fukushima?
I think my answer is on the positive side, though. You know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the U.S. After the Fukushima accident has gone back and asked for a complete review of the way they do business. And a panel has made suggestions. They're working on how to implement these and prioritize these suggestions now. So I think the answer is that this accident in Japan was something that was unforeseen. The question is, are there other similar kinds of things that are unforeseen in the U.S. plants that we should be preparing for?
Mm-hmm.
I think,
It was certainly my understanding that the issue in Japan was that not so much that the emergency shutdown, there was a problem with the emergency shutdown procedures. That worked the way that it did. The problem was that once you shut down the plant, the fuel continues to be very hot, and you have to keep it cool. And it was that system, the cooling system that should have done that, that's what didn't
work. Yes, this is the problem. The reactor was shut. The reactors that were operational were shut down when the earthquake came, and then the cooling was interrupted. It worked for a little bit because of battery backup systems, but it was basically interrupted because of the damage to the diesel generators that should run the pumps to keep the water flow going through the reactor core, and probably also some damage to the pumps. The pumps were located kind of in the basement level, and so there was some issue there about whether they could be restarted and how quickly they could be restarted.
Now, we do in the United States, we do have some boiling water reactors of the similar
generation,
design.
Yeah, and yes.
And is there any place that would be vulnerable potentially to that kind of problem?
I wonder. I don't think so now, but there would potentially be problems if there were major flooding or other kinds of things where a plant might be flooded and interrupt part of its operation. I think in general there are backups for these kinds of things. So I don't see a combination of problems. I think if in the Japanese case, if it were the earthquake alone, then we wouldn't be looking at the damage there. But the tsunami actually did much more damage than when was anticipated in that case.
All right. Well, we'll continue. We'll take another caller. And I think next we will talk with someone in Charleston and our line 4 right here. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I'm coming into the conversation late, so I apologize if you've already covered this. But NPR, they did a segment a month ago and said that there's really no place to store these spent fuel rods. So is it irresponsible for us to start generating more spent fuel rods by opening up more nuclear plants if we're still stuck with nowhere to put them?
Yes, that's a good question. And you know, there was a plan, the plan that had been in process for over 25 years, and this was to build a repository at Yucca Mountain. And you know, the Obama administration has put a halt to that. When putting a halt to it, there was also a Department of Energy-appointed Blue Ribbon panel to make suggestions about what should be done. And this panel has just reported out, maybe two or three weeks ago, the end of July this year, about a series of recommendations. This is a draft report. The final report is due out at the end of the year, beginning of next year. And they agree that there should be some long-term repository developed. There should also be some repository that could store waste on an intermediate time scale develop, part of their recommendations. I don't know that it's irresponsible to do this. I think the question is more that we need to deal with this problem directly. It's become highly politicized, I think. There's a lot of technical capabilities to handle these kinds of things, and other countries have moved forward with this. I should also probably mention in this that there is another nuclear waste community in the U.S., and this is the weapons program waste community, and they do have a repository that's operational in the southern part of New Mexico. So they have a mechanism to deal with their high-level waste, and they've been doing this. So it's not that it's technically impossible. I think the social-political issues need to be handled. The recommendation of the Blue Ribbon panel at this point is that there should be a lot more public engagement and acceptance by the communities that might be affected directly with the development of a repository.
Is there any either political or business process in the works right now to find or designate a new site for this repository?
At this point, no. The plan was to use the Yucca Mountain. This was done. All this process was carried through all the way to the presidential level. Because it's a repository which needs some licensing, it was before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for licensing, and at this point, the process basically stopped. And so there's any repository that would be proposed or built in the future would have to be a licensed nuclear repository. And so this is where we stand. So this we've changed course, and now we're in the process of trying to find out what a better direction would have been.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Sure. All right, thank you. Well, just real quick, as far as Yucca Mountain is concerned, they constructed the site. They went all the way to the point where I believe that it was ready. It could have accepted waste. People there didn't want it. So, and there also were, I think, some scientists were concerned about the suitability and safety of the site. In your estimation, was the decision not to go ahead, was that a scientific decision or was that a political decision?
I think it was much more political than scientific. I'll tell you, the biggest problem with deciding what to do with a repository is looking ahead by thousands of years. And so in any kind of scientific analysis, you can look at the range of possibilities over that long time period and probably come to also a range of conclusions about what the worst case scenario might be if one thing happened or another thing happened. And this was part of the difficulty with convincing people that there should be a repository. I think the concept was that the fuel that goes in should be monitorable. You should be able to monitor how it's being stored, and it should be retrievable. So if something goes wrong, you should be able to take it back out for a period of a couple hundred years. But the big concerns are what happens after 10,000 years or maybe longer. And so these things are there's some scientific basis for making the analysis about what might happen. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to be sure that the analysis is completely correct.
I have some other callers. Again, we'll get right to them. But on that last point, I'm sure that there are some people who will in a sense echo what the last caller said and say something like, does it really make sense for us to be employing this technology that is producing a waste product that is hazardous, that we have to take extreme measures to keep it out of the environment for 10,000 years?
So there are a couple answers, I think, to that issue. One is that the amount of waste actually is not so much. It's a football field size amount of waste that's stacked up maybe 10, 20 feet. It's not a huge amount of waste. Mm-hmm. And if you balance that compared to the amount of carbon we generate, which is a big issue, the amount of per capita, per person carbon generated in the U.S. now is about 20 tons a year. So each of us are responsible more or less by large amounts of other kinds of emissions. And this was, of course, part of the impetus for moving back toward a nuclear solution. I think the real issue, the other side of the question, is that we don't reprocess the fuel. So what goes into the ground basically is exactly the same thing that comes out of the reactor. And if we go through some reprocessing, then we could separate out the things that will live for a very long time, mm-hmm. and things that will live for a very short time, and deal with those differently. So there's been a lot of research effort, we've done some here, to look at what happens with these very long-lived isotopes that you really don't want to bury. The idea would be to put them back in the reactor and basically burn them, destroy them by putting them back in the reactor where they could capture a neutron and convert to some other isotope, which would be easier to deal with. And so there's been a lot of work done here internationally in this area that could change the way we deal with waste overall, mm-hmm. and not make it the 10,000, 100,000 million year problem that it seemed to be.
Right. Well, we have a number of the callers. Let me introduce again our guest, James Stubbins. He is head of the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the U of I, and we're talking about nuclear energy. We'll be doing another program later this week with a different guest with a very different point of view. On Thursday at 11, we'll talk with Dr. Jordan Weaver. He's a science fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council, so you'll have an opportunity to hear another point of view. But certainly this morning, if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And the next caller is in Bement on line number two. Hello.
Good morning. This is it actually applies to this. There was about 30 years ago, there was some experimentation or discussion about baking the isotopes into a ceramic and then coating it with a glass and then burying those basically in drums
to secure them, and that way would take care of the time scale because the ceramic is not going to disappear rapidly. Can he comment about that? And I'll just listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, thank you for the question. There are countries that are looking at this. Actually, Sweden is probably the most advanced in terms of developing a repository. So they have a repository that they're building that's underground in a granite formation, and they would indeed vitrify the waste and bury it in drums that would be also intentionally designed to be corrosion resistant, so typically made out of copper, which also helps with the heat dissipation, which is another issue with the repository. So people have been looking at this. There are lots of approaches. The approach in the U.S., though, is to take the fuel elements, the fuel assemblies, as they are in the reactor and package them in large containers. So nothing is done in the current process between what goes in the reactor and what comes out of the reactor before it goes into the repository. It's just buried in a large pressure-bearing canister, which has basically also been done recently for interim storage, for storage at sites that no longer have enough pool storage to hold all the fuel.
And this is the dry cask?
Yeah, this storage is the dry cask storage approach.
So right now, the fuel, the spent fuel, is being stored at the place where it was generated. Is still most of that still in pool and pools of water?
Most of it's still in pool. The initial plan was to take the fuel when it came out of the reactor and put it in a large swimming pool in racks for a period of about 5 years, probably no longer than 10 years. This was when there was a policy that the waste would be taken away. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is that reactors have been running not 5 years or 10 years, but 20 years and 30 years, and they have all of the fuel still on site. These spent fuel pools, have been re-racked, so they've been made so that they can put the fuel much closer together than it would have been normally designed to do. But now even that's full. So the next possible thing to do is to take that fuel out, put it in dry cask storage and set it outside the containment building, outside the system, typically on a concrete pad someplace where it can be seen and monitored, and the fuel can stay there.
So, and this is sitting out in the open.
Sitting out in the open, but inside the security secure area in the.
And how long is that thought to be
well,
good
for? Well, I think the systems are licensed for maybe 30 years, but I think in general they could be designed to be viable for 50 or more years. There's a lot of thought out there that maybe this is the best interim solution. We should work on the waste problem while we're storing these things in an interim manner. This is part of the Blue Ribbon Commission, I think, report that there should be some fixed interim waste facility so that this isn't spread out everywhere. Illinois also has worked a lot on trying to look at this plan. Professor Singer in my department has worked a lot on trying to see what the waste problems are, where they are, and how they could be addressed in this interim storage manner.
Yeah. All right. To another caller, Champaign County, I believe, is next. Line 3. Hello.
Yeah, I'm generally going to stick to the points that elicited me to call, but Fukushima, the storage tanks were, spent fuels tanks were a problem in it. I think I've heard that it was they put borate in as a neutron flux absorber, right? And
yes.
I think most of the plants are doing that here so they can put it in denser so that when you lose the water, you had a melt, not just in the reactor cores. So that's very concerning, it seems to me.
Yes, this is also driving part of the issue about what to do with all of this fuel that's in spent fuel pools.
Yeah. Okay, well, I wanted to ask you about the old plants. There isn't, despite the fact of this, there's still an effort by utilities to take plants that have passed their design life and ask for an extension from the NRC. It was going through and looked like pretty much rubber stamping, but now with this issue that people are agitated about it, and I think, well, they should be, I can't imagine that any of these utility operators, if they were if the Price-Anderson liability limitation that gives the the problem with a huge, if there was a huge problem, it devolves to the taxpayer, and the corporations are limited liability. I don't think they would be even thinking about extending the life of these old plants that were scheduled to be decommissioned if that liability was taken away from them. So I wanted you to comment on that. I suppose you advocate new plants since you're in the
– Well, I think we need both. This plant license extension is something that started to happen about 10 years ago, maybe a little more than 10 years ago. The plants and the argument is the plants were very conservatively designed when they were first put together. And so they were designed for a 40-year license life. In a lot of cases, there's been a license extension granted that could go up to 60 years. But this requires continuous inspection of the plant. And this probably will happen for probably 80% or maybe more, a higher percentage of the 104 plants we have in operation now.
Yeah, I wonder about inspections when the plant that was being operated in Vermont, the operator denied that there were certain pipes underneath the plant, and they were eventually found out that of course there were, and that's where the tritium was leaking from. But radiation, I wanted some general remarks about just radiation. You hear a lot of people saying, well, it's just the same as background radiation, or it's not, and it doesn't rise above. The problem with a lot of the fission byproducts is that they're chemically active, and they don't give an even, you can't average them out. Strontium will go into your bones and super irradiate your bone marrow, and things like that happen. So that's a consideration just in the language. I know you're quite familiar with all of that, but in the discourse of superficial discourse we get from the media, GE, NBC, I guess they're not owned by anymore, we don't get a lot of a deep analysis of that. And it seems to me that's an important consideration because contrary to what people are saying about Fukushima being localized, there are people on the West Coast that say they're seeing patterns of actually health effects, and it's because you can't average this radiation plume the same way as you can the background radiation. It hits certain places more than others, and there are people that are arguing that these radiation plumes have had localized effects on the West Coast. I'm sure you'll probably poo-poo that, and I don't have the statistical analysis to decide on that. But there are definitely people that are making that argument, and it weather is also, you know, you can't expect a weather front to conveniently average out the radiation plume over the whole Pacific. Some of it's going to travel in patterns.
I think you're right about this. In general, I don't know about these reports from the West Coast. I know that there were the people in the Seattle area, for instance, were able to measure some low levels of radiation. I haven't heard anything about health effects. But I think the point that you made earlier is the correct point, that all radiation isn't the same. If you get an X-ray, it's different than if you ingest strontium-90. So the way particularly isotopes tend to concentrate in the body makes a big difference. I'm one of those kids that was around in the atmospheric atomic testing days when people were very worried about strontium-90 falling out of the atmosphere and getting eaten by cows and kids drinking the milk from the cows and getting bone cancer from strontium-90 concentrating in bones. So I think these things are around. As a matter of fact, even at Fukushima, there was some radioactive materials found that was there probably from fallout from atmospheric atomic weapons tests. So that is a concern. I think there's been a lot of work to figure out what these effects are and how damaging they are. There was recently, I think this March, another report in a series of reports on the bomb survivors at Nagasaki and Hiroshima in Japan, where there's a lot of statistical information about cancer rates and other kinds of things that can happen. But the other side of the point, of course, is that a lot of those people, when these bombs were dropped in 1945, are still alive. A lot of people in the Chernobyl area who were exposed are still alive. So these long-term health effects can be there, and people are studying what to do about this or how the effects occur.
I hope the caller will forgive me. I have some other people I want to get to, and we're coming into our last 15 or so minutes, and we're talking this morning with James Stubbins, who is head of the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the U of I, and we'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Hour two today, we'll talk with Bob Berman. He's an astronomy writer, and we will talk about a new book that he has out that's about the sun. The Sun's Heartbeat is the title. It's all about the sun and how it works and how it affects life on Earth. Also want to mention that tonight at 9 o'clock on WILL-TV, also on WILL-AM and online, I'll be sitting down for a conversation with the president of the University of Illinois, Michael Hogan. This is a live show. We'll talk about a number of things. Last time we talked was in the winter, and a lot has happened since then. We'll try to get caught up, as we always do on these programs, we tell people who are watching, listening, they can call with questions. So if you can, tune in. That's tonight at 9 o'clock on WILL-TV AM and online. In this hour of the show, James Stubbins is our guest, and we're talking about nuclear energy. He is head of the Department of Nuclear Plasma and Radiological Engineering at the U of I. We have some callers here, a couple of people who have been waiting patiently. We'll get to them, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Urbana is next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Perhaps you'd comment on the Russia's continuing Chernobyl problem. A recent New York Times article stated that there are cracks in the coverage of the defunct plant, and they are now building a 20,000-ton sarcophagus on rails that they will then, once they finish constructing it, then they will slide it over the plant. The cost is $2 billion, of which Russia is only paying $100 million, and the European community will pay the rest of it.
Yes, and I'm not completely familiar with this. I've seen the design, and I've seen how this should operate. And you're right, the initial efforts to take care of to isolate the problem at Chernobyl have now aged enough and had problems enough when they were putting it down that they need to build another larger sarcophagus to cover everything. I don't know where the funding. It's news to me where the funding is coming from. Of course, Chernobyl's in Ukraine now, which is independent from Russia, and so I'm not quite sure where the division of costs are going to come from.
What do you? Is there some estimates? Have there been some estimates put on what it's going to cost to do the cleanup in Japan?
No, I don't think people know yet. The latest news from Japan is that they nearly have the temperatures under control in the reactors. Mm-hmm. So this has taken now. It's middle of March. And now we're approaching the end of August, and it's taken this long. I think this problem is going to take a decade or longer to figure out how to deal with.
Well, that's indeed. I have read that I believe that TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, has said that it believes that the reactors can be brought fully under control and emissions of radiation stopped by the end of the year. But then people say to really clean up from this could take 10 years, could take more, and that there are some people. It may well be that there are some people who had lived there in the vicinity that will never be able to go back.
Yeah, I don't know. There was an announcement yesterday or a few days ago that this 12.5-mile radius zone, there was more contamination than anticipated, and this may not allow people to go back home. Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember, though, is the longer you wait to clean the problem up, the less radioactivity you have to deal with. And so if there's no driving force to do things quickly, that you're not spreading additional contamination or causing other kinds of problems, then in a lot of cases it's better to wait a while to try and take care of these problems than to do it quickly.
Let's talk with another caller here, Champagne, line two. Hello.
My understanding, there's a plant in Braidwood, Illinois. It never went online,
I think it's used maybe for storage or something or other, and there was, I think there was also a problem with that. So what was it, how come it never went online?
Well, I'm not sure about Braidwood. There are reactors at Braidwood that are working. I think the thing that you're referring to is a General Electric-owned fuel processing repository in Morris, Illinois. So
okay.
It's in the Chicago area. This plant was built to accept spent nuclear fuel. So spent nuclear fuel has been shipped in certain cases. General Electric had, and there was another similar operation in West Valley in New York. Both of these kinds of operations were intended to take nuclear fuel, reprocess it, and sell the useful material back, which would be some mixture of the remaining uranium and some plutonium that would have been developed during the time the fuel was in the reactor. And this would have some economic value. So the concept when this was done in the 70s was to reprocess fuel, take back the parts of the fuel that were still useful, and use that to refabricate new fuel. This process is being carried forward in many countries in the world. In France now is particularly at the lead of doing this. But the processes that were developed at the time in the 70s in the U.S. Were not economically viable. Then at the end of the 70s, we developed this policy that we wouldn't reprocess. And so that fuel's been sitting there since the 70s. It's a licensed facility. It was relicensed maybe 5 years ago by the NRC to hold spent nuclear fuel. And it's in Morris, Illinois, so it's in the state of Illinois, just a little bit to the west and a little south of Chicago.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. And the reason that we don't reprocess is because in addition to getting something that you could use in a nuclear plant, also you get something that you could use in a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, it's actually very difficult from nuclear fuel to use something that you can use in a weapon, but this was the argument initially. The argument is that you can take plutonium out of the fuel. Plutonium is chemically different than uranium, so it's a much easier process to separate plutonium from uranium than it is one isotope of uranium from another isotope of uranium. But the kind of plutonium you have in spent nuclear fuel is mixed with several isotopes, only a couple of which are really useful for weapons production.
So you have to then further refine that.
You have to further refine them. Yes, but the U.S. policy was basically in this direction. I think there is now a lot of concern, a lot of studies. Now, you can find a range of results that say also it's more costly to do this than to not do this. It's more costly to reprocess than to not reprocess. But I think the thing people, your listeners, should understand is that the U.S. has a much different policy on nuclear waste. The nuclear waste is a government problem. We pay a small amount, a tenth of a penny per kilowatt hour, for handling nuclear waste, and that goes to the government. In other countries, this is not a government problem. It has to be handled by the utilities or in some other way. And so in the U.S., this nuclear waste policy has been separated from the other operational aspects of running the reactors.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it's the complaint of the utilities is that, well, it's actually their problem because they still have to deal
with it. Yes, and now there have been a number of suits in the last few years that the government actually does own the spent fuel and they should take care of it. And so there's been a lot of money transferred back and, well, from the government to utilities to move toward this dry cask storage, which is the only interim solution which seems viable at present. But there are, I looked this morning, there's about $35 billion collected in this fund, and about four from the state of Illinois, where we have a lot of reactors.
All right. We have maybe about 5 minutes left. Someone here in Thomasboro, they're next. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. You know, we've talked about the, you know, spent fuel problem, but also I think probably consideration we need to have, and maybe the guest can address that, is first off, you know, we got the mine tailings problem, but then when we get to the enrichment process at Oak Ridge, Paducah, or Portsmouth, over 99% by mass, everything goes in, comes out as uranium hexafluoride, which is just pure waste also. So we've got a tremendous amount of waste just from the enrichment process that's not being addressed. It's just left there in casks. It's a gas left in the cask sitting down there with what they don't know what to do with. At the same time, we have an incredible problem with the spent waste.
Well, let me say this. I think most people probably don't know that when you dig uranium out of the ground, the fraction that's really useful for fuel is only about 0.7%, less than 1%. And in order to use it for fuel, at least in the kind of reactors in most of the Western world, the uranium needs to be enriched to about 4%, 3 or 4 or 5% in that range, which means for every pound of uranium you dig out of the ground, only about a tenth of a pound is useful for fuel. The other nine-tenths is depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is not particularly harmful, difficult to deal with. Actually, we do that here at the university. We have depleted uranium samples we look at. But there is a large mass of material that's set aside because of this enrichment processing. On the other hand, if you look at Canada, which doesn't enrich the fuel, they send all of the fuel through the reactor. They still burn this small fraction, which is U-235, the uranium-235 isotope, but then they generate basically about 10 times as much waste to deal with. And so there's a whole – by concentrating the uranium to start with, there's a much smaller waste problem to deal with after the fuel's been in the reactor.
Yeah, but we still have the uranium hexafluoride fluoride problem.
Well, yeah, but this is typically reprocessed into uranium dioxide, which is basically a ceramic, inert ceramic.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We have just about 5 minutes left. I want to come back to something we talked about at the beginning of the program, at least a little bit. We talked about just how expensive it is to build a nuclear plant.
Yes.
And now I know that your the university has just recently gotten a research grant from the Department of Energy to look at ways to make plants safer, more efficient. Does that also in any way touch on the cost of building a plant?
Well, the thing that we're looking at is building very high temperature reactors, and the effort to do this is because as you go up in temperature of the system, you can make the system much more efficient. So current energy conversion systems are particularly ones that deal with making steam, are about 30 to 40%, probably not even 40% efficient. That is, for every unit of heat, you make only 30% of that into electricity, or 35%. If we can go to much higher temperatures, we can approach 50, 60% efficiency. For every unit of heat, 50 or 60% of it becomes electricity. But the other advantage, the thing that we're really interested in doing, is if you can go to high enough temperatures, we can drive thermoprocessing cycles, thermochemical cycles. And in that case, we can very efficiently basically strip water apart and make hydrogen as a fuel. So the hydrogen fuel cycle would replace a lot of petroleum if we can get to high enough temperatures to make these processes actually very efficient. And so this is part of the effort, is to move away from just generating electricity into a realm where we could compete with petroleum resources by generating hydrogen.
So let me make sure I understand it. So you would still be generating electricity.
We could still generate electricity with this system. We could do the concepts are generate electricity in the day when people need it most, and generate hydrogen at night when the electricity demands are lower.
Mm-hmm. As this gets us into the what is an entirely different subject, that is moving perhaps away from liquid transportation fuels to possibly powering vehicles with hydrogen. But then, of course, the question is, okay, where are you going to get the hydrogen? You can't just grab it out of the air.
Yes, it's a secondary source, and so you have to have some primary energy source to get it. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you also, Illinois is at the lead of developing technology for hydrogen. The director of an institute, which is stationed in Japan, actually, that's looking at hydrogen production for green energy. And the Japanese are looking at having hydrogen, a major fleet of hydrogen vehicles on the road by 2015.
The cost of building a plant over time has gone up just tremendously, to the point where I think that I read, you know, back in the 70s, to build a plant for every kilowatt that the plant was going to put out, it cost like less than $400, and now it's way over $5,000 to do the equivalent
work. Yes, the
prices
have gone up. Actually, over the past 10 years, probably, the prices have gone up, and this is what slowed things down quite a bit. But I have to tell you that if you look at the interest rates that people paid on the loans in the 70s and 80s, People probably remember that the interest rates were 10 or 15%. Yeah. And my guess is that the cost of the Clinton power station, which is close by, should have been maybe $600 million to start with. It ended up being like $4 billion. I would guess that a large fraction of that, maybe even half of that, is interest on the loans because of the period it took to borrow the money to build the plant. And this is why there's a lot of effort now to shorten the construction time, to do licensing and site licensing, reactor type licensing and site licensing in parallel, and reduce the amount of interest and risk in the loans that are needed to build new plants.
Well, is it you talked just earlier about the fact that technologically speaking, a nuclear plant is a very complicated thing, much more complicated than a coal burning plant or a natural gas burning plant. But having said that, would it be possible by coming up with some different kind of design? And I think that people have made the arguments that simpler, more standardized designs could be used, and that the result there would be that the cost you could do something about the cost.
Yes,
of building
the plant. And so there's a major program which has been moving forward for the last couple of years, and this is to build small modular reactors. And the idea is to build reactors that are the scale. A typical reactor produces about 1,000 megawatts of electricity. These would produce somewhere in the range of 100 megawatts electricity. So you'd need maybe 8 or 10 of them to be equivalent to the large-scale power plant. But the concept is you could build these in a factory. You don't need to build them on site. You could then move them to the site, and you could have maybe two of these operational to start with and put them in the rate base and start to pay for the next two. And then you have the next two, then you put those in a rate base, and you could basically piggyback the economics of this on top of each other. And it turns out the U.S. has extremely capable people in this area, because these are reactors kind of like the ones that drive our submarines and our aircraft carriers. Mm-hmm. These are small modular reactors that the Navy's been building with various vendors for 50 years.
And those, they would still be, they would, even though you'd have a number of small reactions, they would essentially still all be at one.
Yeah, there would be an island cluster. So you can share services between them, mm-hmm. and you can share control and personnel, all these kinds of things, fuel handling, all of these things could be shared. Mm-hmm. And this would also help the economics of the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're here essentially the point where we're going to about have to stop. If one was going to say if you decided that it was a good thing to revive this industry and start building plants again, what would have to happen? In your estimation, what would have to happen?
Well, the major issue, I think, still is the cost issue where we started. Mm-hmm. It's an issue that there needs to be enough financial wherewithal to get over the hump of building plants. Once they're built and operational, we have a lot of experience. There's a lot of experience around the world doing these things. It's the initial investment and maybe the risk in the initial investment that still seems the biggest difficulty.
Mm-hmm. And you would argue that this is something that we should do as a country?
Yes,
Yes,
I would argue it's something we should do as a mix of our energy sources. I don't think any nuclear person you'd talk to would say this isn't the solution, it's part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at the greenhouse gas and environmental impact, we've talked about the waste some, but other than that, it's the least environmental impact that you can find in large-scale energy sources.
All right. There we'll have to leave it. Our guest is James Stubbins. He is head of the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. Could I make one more comment?
Oh, yes.
I'm happy about the next hour, because the next hour is about the sun, which is another large nuclear system.
A different kind of nuclear system,
but people should be aware that it's the power of the universe is a nuclear
All right.
power source.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
We will break at this point, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, corn futures are making new contract highs today. Well, soybean futures are rallying close to the 1403 area, which is the very, very top, the quad top of the range that soybeans has been trading in since the beginning of this year. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat now trading 833, up 11 and a quarter. December 857, up 11. March 868 and a half, up 11. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 751 and three quarters, up 16 and a quarter. December 780, up 14. March 810, up 13 and a half. September corn, 729, up 8 and a half. December 742 and a half, up 8. March 753 and three quarters, up 6 and three quarters. May 757 and a half, up 7. July 758 and a half, up 6 and three quarters. September soybeans, 1387.